Hornstein, present. Vice Chair Cagle?
Present.
Cagle, present. Representative Petersburg?
Present.
Petersburg, present. Representative Barr?
Here.
Barr, present. Representative Bernardi? Representative Bernardi? Representative Elkins?
Present.
Elkins, present. Representative Frederick?
Present.
Frederick, present. Representative Hausman?
Present.
Hausman, present. Representative Heinrich?
Present.
Heinrich, present. Representative Kosmic?
Present.
Kosmic, present. Representative Mason? Representative Mason? Representative Murphy? Representative Murphy? Representative Nelson?
Present.
Nelson, present. Representative Olson?
Present.
Olson, present. Representative Richardson?
Present.
Richardson, present. Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Torkelson, present. Representative West?
Present.
West, present. There is a quorum.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi is present.
Bernardi is present. Okay, members, thank you. And before we get into the bills that we're hearing today and our informational portion of the hearing, we are going to have an item of business. That is the approval of the minutes. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the minutes of the February 18th, I believe that's right, 18th minutes of this committee.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Is there discussion? Seeing none, we can do this as a voice vote. Members, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Thank you very much, Representative Petersburg. Members, before I hand over the virtual gavel to our Vice Chair, Representative Cagle, I just wanted to outline what we're doing today. We will have an informational hearing on the sections of House File 1027. That is the governor's budget proposal, which I'm introducing. That is the sections pertaining to the governor's budget on DPS. And just because for new members and others tuning in, this is a courtesy that we extend to the governor. We may take some of these provisions. We will really do our own bill on all aspects of the budget. But we take very seriously what the governor has to say and his agencies, and hence we are giving all of the agencies under our jurisdiction an opportunity to share their budget and their proposals with us. That's what this is. This hearing is going to encompass here for about the first 45 minutes or so, and we'll hear from the governor's folks for about a half hour. We'll have some question and answer, and then we're going to hear from members of the Minnesota Council on Disability and other organizations, ARC, the Autism Society of Minnesota, their concerns about transportation. And then we're going to hear the MnDOT pedestrian report, a report they've done about pedestrian issues, and have some commentary about that. So it'll take us to 2:30. And with that, I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Cagle.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so today, Representative Hornstein is presenting House File 1027. If you'd like to go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, as I mentioned, this is the governor's budget bill as it pertains to the Department of Public Safety. And I will just ask the members of the Department of Public Safety leadership to present their budget. And after they conclude, we'll have questions and answers from the committee. We have Commissioner Harrington, Colonel Langer, and DVS Director Emma Corey all lined up to speak. And I believe Commissioner Harrington is going first. Is that am I correct in that?
Yes, sir, you are correct.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Harrington. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle. I'm John M. Harrington, the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The Department of Public Safety's mission is to serve all Minnesota communities by building a safer Minnesota. We have been working through a process of doing both community outreach and enhanced customer service to try and enhance the mission of public safety, whether that is traffic safety on our roads and highways, safety around the Capitol, which is also one of our responsibilities, and enhancing safety by making sure that we regulate the motor vehicle, both licensing of the vehicles and the drivers through the Department of Vehicle Services. Today, you're going to hear from Colonel Matt Langer, Colonel of the Minnesota State Patrol, who has done an exceptional job of both traffic enforcement and traffic safety and education, but has also has been my number one and right-hand person as we have tried to make sure that the Capitol itself is safe and secure during these rather uncertain times. You'll also hear from Emma Corey, who is my Director of Vehicle Services. The highlight that we always talk about at DPS is that we no longer use the words MNLARS as a verb anymore. When I came into this office, that was the term. I can't MNLARS today or bad things were happening. And I think I sent a message out to Representative Hornstein and others that we have powered down MNLARS, that the actual servers are being dismantled, and I'm confident that they will never be heard of again, other than as a historical reference. So, as I said, the Department of Public Safety's priority in this budget is really to enhance customer service and accountability. And you're going to hear from my staff as they talk about body-worn cameras. They're going to talk about Capitol security and real ID. We are at the Department of Public Safety, a conglomerate. We are in two different committees. We're in the Public Safety Committee and also in the Transportation Committee. If you look at us, there are 11 different divisions. On the transportation side, the biggest divisions are both the State Patrol and DVS in terms of the number of staff. But the Office of Traffic Safety is an absolute, Mike Hansen's division is absolutely essential in mapping and educating and working with us to try and make sure that highway safety is kept in mind. And toward that end, recently we have been doing a big speed reduction effort trying to make sure that the motorists that we have seen out there that literally are doing well in excess of 100 miles an hour because they, for whatever reason, think that they can stop their car on a dime in Minnesota weather and Minnesota roads. We need to get them to slow down because our crash rate is historic and our fatal rate is growing and growing and growing. In addition to that, we have the Office of Pipeline Safety, and then there are number of other administrative related services that we also operate. On the public safety side, for those, we have alcohol gambling enforcement, which regulates liquor licensed establishments, both bars and liquor stores. But they also regulate all of the gambling, whether it's pull tabs, all the way through casino gambling and slot machines. State Fire Marshal is our state fire investigators and also are the state fire training operations that train all of the firefighters, whether they're professional firefighters and full-time firefighters, as you see in the Twin Cities, or the volunteer firefighters and the on-call firefighters, which make up actually the vast majority of firefighters across the state of Minnesota. The Office of Justice Programs is our victim services unit, and they do both crime victims reparations and also make sure that if there are complaints about the criminal justice system, that we have a place for folks that are not happy with the way the system is working come to. ECN, which is probably one of the least known operations, regulates the 911 system and the interoperability system that allows police, fire, medics, and everybody else to talk to each other across the state of Minnesota, and especially in an emergency. Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which I think is at 345 days of successful operation, where they have been operating, running the COVID, much of the COVID operation with the Department of Health. And then the BCA, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, which is our state investigative agency. Those comprise the Department of Public Safety. For this committee, the ones that we're going to highlight today are the Minnesota State Patrol and the Driver and Vehicle Services. Next slide, please. So what we are talking about today is our budget overview, and there are really three parts of that. The first one I'll talk about, and then, as I said, Colonel Langer and Emma Corey will talk about the others. The DPS operating adjustment. The operating adjustment is what we need in order to be able to pay all the bills that have come up in the interim. So increase in funding necessary for rent. That goes up whether we wanted to. IT costs, running the IT structure statewide has a cost. Our legal issues have come up as a cost. And then compensation, which is a huge piece of this, with contract negotiations constantly going on with a variety of different unions and the different groups here, we have to make sure that we have operating under those new guidelines. And so we'll be asking for additional adjustments within our budget there. Next slide. So our operating adjustment, we're looking at a reduction in FY 2021. That's due to the state hiring freeze and several other operating efficiencies over the last year. Part of those you'll hear from Director Corey as we talk about, in part because of the shutdown of many DDS offices and exam stations due to COVID. There was a period of time where we had far less operating expenses, and so we had some operating efficiencies there. And then as we came out of that, we had to figure out how would we do driver's license testing and others in a COVID environment. How do you put people into a car, far less than 6 feet separation, even with masks and things along that lines, and do it in a safe way and still keep up with the demand? And there was a extremely high demand for driver's license tests. And then there are also some really essential driver's license tests, like the Class C commercial driver's licenses we needed to make sure we got done in time for farming and things along that lines. As I said, we're looking at increases in funding also as we move forward on compensation, rent, and IT and legal. There's a $220,000 reduction in FY 2021, but an increase of $824,000 in FY 22 and $1.4 million in fiscal year 23, which is an ongoing request. Next slide. At this time, I would turn it over to Colonel Matt Langer, unless there are questions from the committee for me.
Welcome, Colonel Langer. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thanks, Commissioner, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Langer, and I have the honor and privilege of serving as Chief of the Minnesota State Patrol. And my opportunity before you today is to go through some of the budget items that we have in the governor's budget that we'll be pursuing this year. The first thing that you'll see, and I know many of you have been members of the Transportation Committee for a long time, and you know full well what the Minnesota State Patrol does, but you can see our mission statement on the screen. And we are all about traffic safety. That's the bulk of what we do, but it's not everything that we do. There's a few buzzwords in our mission statement. Three of them that I point out all the time are assistance, education, and enforcement. That really describes the majority of our work across the state of Minnesota. We do an incredible amount of assistance, both to people that run out of gas or have a flat tire or their car breaks down, or the other law enforcement agencies that require help along the way. And we focus really strongly on education along with enforcement, because it is our belief that we won't be successful solving traffic safety problems through education alone, nor will we be successful solving traffic safety problems through enforcement alone. But through both of those together with assistance, we can provide the service that Minnesotans have come to expect from the Minnesota State Patrol all the way back to 1929. Next slide, please. Just jumping right in no particular order to our budget request here. The first item is a civil unrest response change item, and this relates both to the general fund, the work around the state capitol and the capitol complex that we've had in this fiscal year, particularly increased since January when we had the insurrection in Washington, D.C., and the related issues we've had around our own Capitol complex with the various protest events that have really been unrelenting over the past year or more. So you'll see a general fund increase for FY21 and then a trunk highway fund increase in FY21 as well to help us cover the costs that we anticipate needing related to the Derek Chauvin trial with jury selection starting March 8th. I will say, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that both of these numbers continue to be in flux somewhat because the planning efforts continue. And so there's some moderation and changes that's occurring as we speak with these numbers. And the closer we get to some of the events happening, the better off we'll be with the projections. But both of these items are really important for us to get out of the fiscal year in sound shape. The next item is a 8.4% salary increase for troopers. One of the things that happened legislatively during a special session last year was an increase directed by the legislature for state troopers and state troopers only to receive an 8.4% increase to their salary. Along with that increase came one-time funds to get us through this fiscal year, and what we are needing are the tails for that increase to continue into the future, so you can see the calculated cost of the tails into the future for those increases. And I'll note that, as the commissioner outlined, although the total number is about 5.9 million, that is split across the funds that are appropriated to the state patrol, including the general fund, the trunk highway fund, which includes commercial motor vehicle enforcement, and then HUTD, which is primarily our vehicle crimes unit group. The third item on the screen is an academy carry forward piece of legislation that we're seeking. It basically allows for a reduction in this year's appropriation and allows us to carry that into FY22. The reason for this is just simply that our academy got delayed because we didn't receive the funding that we needed during the regular special session. We received that funding during one of the subsequent special sessions. And so that put our academy timeline behind where it would normally be. And so we will have these cadets hired. They'll be in the Lido Academy this summer, but they will not be graduated and on the road by June 30th. And so since we'll have them hired and then in the midst of their training, we're seeking the ability to carry forward 1.7 1.8 million from FY21 to FY22, because that is the projected cost to get those cadets to graduation in the new fiscal year. Next slide, Jordan. This top item here is a big ticket item for us. It's state patrol body-worn cameras. We are quickly becoming antiquated as a law enforcement agency, both in Minnesota and across the country, because state troopers do not currently have body-worn cameras. And so this line item, this change item, would allow us to outfit the entire Minnesota State Patrol, both the state troopers and the Capitol Security officers and the commercial motor vehicle inspectors, the non-sworn positions that interact with the public, with body-worn cameras. You can see the cost is about 4.5 million the first year and 3.6 ongoing. The first year with some deployment costs a little bit more, but we're talking about 700 to 800 devices actually deployed. So it's a significant undertaking, but it's one that's really important. And I might add is one that the troopers and the Capitol Security officers and the commercial vehicle inspectors are wanting. They're eager for them. They're proud of their work, and they want to, as the commissioner stated, lean into that accountability, both on their behavior and holding accountable those that they interact with. The second item is Capitol Security enhancements. We've had great discussions thanks to the Capitol Security Advisory Committee, and we've presented some options that have been received well by that body. This is a total of 8.47 in the FY22 and a little over 4 million in FY23. This adds 34 dedicated positions, including 21 of those being sworn state troopers. It also includes some technology pieces to mobile devices so we can better track assets. And it includes some state-of-the-art training components too, to really do our best to learn what has occurred both in Minnesota and across the country and implement what we have found by researching events into the current training methodology of our Capitol Security unit, who does a great job of managing the daily work of the state capitol and the complex related to people who come and visit, school groups that come and visit once buildings open up again after COVID, the legislators that do their work there, and the many, many other people that have business in the Capitol complex. The next piece is a minor one, but it's important, and it's the last one that I'll cover. We have discovered recently that we don't have a statutory mechanism to get rid of abandoned cash. And so if a vehicle is found on the side of the road and it has money in it, or there's unclaimed cash as a result of a vehicle that was forfeited from an arrest, There's a variety of reasons that we as an agency come across money that is abandoned. In other words, there's nobody that claims it as their own. And so we have great policy and controls in place to deposit those abandoned funds and to track them, but there's no statutory ability to use those funds. And so what we're looking for here is the authority to deposit those funds into the general fund. The revenue is currently at about $70,000, and we estimate it's about $15,000 per year that needs to be cleaned up so it can go somewhere other than in the account where it's sort of trapped right now. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions on those budget items for the State Patrol.
Thank you, Colonel Langer. And I see we do have one question for Representative Petersburg, but if we could just finish this group, would that be okay if we came back to you, Representative Petersburg?
Absolutely.
All right. So next on the agenda is Director Emma Corey, if you want to just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hornstein. My name is Emma Corey, and I am the Driver and Vehicle Services Director. Thank you for this opportunity to present on our budget for DVS. As the Commissioner mentioned, I want to start by saying that I am proud on behalf of DVS, on behalf of our deputy registrars, as well as Minute and our FAST vendor, to say that we successfully launched the Minnesota Drive system on November 16th of 2020. And we are moving forward with this budget request based on the technology platform that MnDrive provides. So on this particular slide, I want to focus on two things that this budget request is based on. One, our focus is on optimizing the technology that Minnesota Drive has provided us, and providing that increased level of online options and customer service options for both our business partners as well as our customers. The second is our focus on really challenging ourselves at DVS to build some operational efficiencies, staffing efficiencies, space efficiencies. And basically, COVID was a forced pilot for us. It allowed us to see what we could do and the efficiencies that we could really reap from a consolidated efficient model. So the basis of this budget request, two things: more technology options for customers, and two, greater operational efficiencies. Jordan, we can go to the next slide. So the first item on our budget request is the Real ID temporary funding. We are requesting a one-time allocation appropriation of $2.4 million for fiscal year 22. You already appropriated this to us in the last year, but as you are aware, the federal Real ID timeline has been shifted a year. So we are asking for that funding in fiscal year 22, so that we can bring on the temp staff, meet the needs of Minnesotans, and get them travel ready by October 1st, 2021. Of course, this is a one-time request. The next one is focused on our staffing and operations. This request is a $5.9 million request in FY22, and then approximately 2.9 going into the future. This is focusing on physicians. So as I said, the Minnesota Drive system came out of VTRS funds. That team, core team of eight, that will allow us to enhance and build on that technology needs to now move on to operating funds. So these dollars are asking for funding for the MnDrive team. It is asking for cross-trained staff that can work with issuing titles, issuing driver's licenses. Our focus is to optimize staff so they can help with wherever the busy season is. Same way for inspectors. We're asking for vehicle inspectors. These are folks, if they can do the dealer inspections, our examiners can focus on road tests. So our focus moving forward is to optimize and cross-train our staff so that we can really optimize efficiencies. We did that during COVID, and we got results that we have never had before, and we hope to be able to do that. So this amount that you see in front of you, $5.9 million, greater amount of investment upfront because this also includes infrastructure needs. We want to relocate the Wilmus exam station location. We have grown out of that location. We need a bigger space. We are looking at 3 locations that we want to add as full service stations so that we can do transactions as well as knowledge tests, as well as road tests. So we're talking about a consolidated model with greater services. And that is the intent. And so greater expense in the first year and then more of a lower expense in future years. We're also talking about a mobile service unit, a unit that can go to correctional facilities or housing locations where folks can be able to get their services met out of a mobile service delivery unit. So we're looking at translations of the driver services manual. So several things that are in here, but the focus being on being able to put in some operational efficiencies and offer better customer service across the state in all corners of the state. Next slide. The next one is focusing on the license plate fee restructure. This particular one is focused on removing our dependency on the highway user, the tax fund, and basically removing the 8.26 that comes out of the HUTD fund and going with a standard $13.50 or $15 for license plate fees. This fee increase will remove our dependence on HUTD and allow that to focus on road projects, bridge projects, but our focus would be to be able to get that 8.236 with license fees that would cover the entire cost of license plates. This is, and the next one is partial payment for driver's license reinstatement. This particular one, what it does is that it allows that partial payment option for all, all individuals with an impaired driving arrest. And so what this will do is it does charge for a reinstatement fee. It will increase revenues, but it will also increase equity in the way of allowing people the option to not have to pay that large amount in one sum, but in installments. The expanded lifetime veteran plates. As you know, several of these veteran plates are lifetime plates, but plates like Proud to be a Veteran, American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, Veterans Foreign Affairs, Foreign Wars, many of these are seven-year plates. This will, across the board, make these lifetime plates a gesture of respect for our veterans. Next slide, please. The OLA has, as a result of an OLA audit, there are some recommendations. As you know, we have data requests for motor vehicle data as well as driver's license data. At the current time, we charge a fee for one and we don't for the other. What this does is it allows us to charge a uniform fee across the board for motor vehicle data as well as for driver's license data. It is expected to bring in a revenue of $72,000 roughly each year. The next one focuses on temporary trip permits. And this one, at the current time, Minnesota companies, our own companies, are bearing the brunt of a higher rate for our trip permits as compared to pass-through out-of-state commercial vehicle companies. And so what this particular change does, it allows to have the same permit, same trip permit fee for all carriers. And that does expect to bring in a revenue of $152,000, $168,000 in future years. And finally, this last one is focusing on the citizen crash report. I won't go into too much detail because I know my colleague, Colonel Langer, is here and he can speak to it. And we are basically requesting, DBS is requesting to eliminate the citizen crash report. Colonel Langer, if you might, wouldn't mind speaking to this and the value of eliminating the crash report at this time.
Colonel Langer?
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Director Corey. I appreciate the opportunity just to weigh in on this. You know, the citizen crash report has been something that has lived in statute for many, many years. And I think once upon a time it had a purpose in state government, but that purpose is no longer valid. And so to be quite candid with members of this committee, right now we're requiring citizens to fill out a crash report after they've been involved in a crash where it's required. And they have to fill that in or go online. And then once those reports are received in DVS, they're not used for anything. And that's just the candid answer. And so this is, I think, a good piece of legislation, in our opinion, that helps streamline some things and make it easier for those citizens who are involved in a crash to have one less thing that they have to do, especially since it no longer has a purpose that is meaningful. Thank you.
Director Corey?
And with that, I will pass it back to Commissioner Harrington.
Thank you. So it sounds like we're ready to take some questions. So first up on our list is Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a question for Corporal Langer and then for MnDrive as well. But my question is this next set of cadets coming through this summer and when they graduate, how many do we have in the class this year? And will that then give us a full complement of officers, or will we still be short on personnel? And then I have a follow-up question for MnDrive.
Colonel Langer?
Madam Chair, Representative Petersburg, good question. So right now we have 31 cadets at Camp Ripley. We hired them as part of the traditional hiring process. We also have 30 cadets right now working through the academic process before they can enter our academy, and they're in the LEADO process. It's kind of a widely held misnomer that there is a complement at the Minnesota State Patrol of X number of troopers. We don't have a complement, but what I take as very serious in my responsibility is the quest to hire as many troopers as I can within the appropriation that we have from the legislature. And of course, there are many other things that go into the work of the Minnesota State Patrol, but the bread and butter, the backbone of who we are as an agency is, of course, the state troopers, followed closely by our non-sworn staff that do a great job supporting all the work of the troopers. And so right now we're doing the best we can to hire replacements for all of the vacant positions that we have, but we're not actively attempting to grow the state patrol other than in that capital security change item request. And the recruitment environment is difficult, as members of this committee, I'm sure, are aware for a variety of reasons, but I'm still really energized by the number of men and women who are eager to join the ranks of the State Patrol.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. I appreciate that information. Getting back to the license plate fee increase, the $2, I have a couple of questions regard to that whole section there. One is where is that $2 going to? Because I'm also concerned about deputy registers and the last Office of Legislative Auditors report that indicated that everybody knows that there's more work being done at the deputy register office without getting any additional fee structure. So how does that work into this particular budget? Where do those $2 go? And how do we compensate for the deputy registers?
Director Corey?
Madam Chair and members, Representative Petersburg, thank you for the question. Yes, the calculation to bring it to 1350 and 15 across the board for our license plate fees. That fund, that calculation is exactly based on an $8.236 million appropriation that we currently get from HUTD. So it would replace the $8.236 from the HUTD fund, and it will cover the current cost of license plates. We, as you know, we use MinCor to print and mail our license plates, and so that is the true cost of the production and the mailing and shipping and handling of license plate fees.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. Then I'll have just one follow-up comment, Madam Chair, is that so it sounds like there's not going to be $8 million in this budget proposal coming out of HUTD. Does that mean that HUTD will have that many more dollars available for other projects? And it still doesn't deal with how we deal with the deputy registers who are doing more work for basically the same amount or less. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Director Corey, did you have any response to that?
It's true that that amount will be available in HUTD for other projects. Yes, it will not be. So there will be $8.236 million additional in the HUTD for allocation elsewhere.
Thank you. Next up, we have Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Director Corey, you had mentioned, and Commissioner Harrington had also mentioned about the road test is something that we've talked about in the past. Can you just give us a little bit more detail and maybe send me some stuff offline too? You'd said, if I heard you correctly, you're looking at adding three new locations and you want additional funding to consolidate the model of the exam stations. So I'm a little curious about that. That's the first I've heard of it, which could be good. Could maybe I have concerns, I'm not sure. But then also talk to us, give us an update about the scheduling of road test. How far out are we scheduling and are we meeting our statutory requirements on that?
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. And that's also another question I had. I was kind of curious what the consolidated exam station model was. So Director Corey.
Absolutely, Madam Chair, Representative Kosnick, and members of the committee, thank you for that question. Several comments that I will try to tie together. So when we talk about our exam station model currently, we have 93 different locations. Many of them are satellite locations, one day a month, one day a week, two days every other month, things like that. So very, very, if I may say, not the most efficient way of providing services. What COVID did is we consolidated down, and it's a lot easier to have 100% focus on health and safety in 15 locations than compromising health and safety in 93 locations. And examiners traveling to all these locations. So the consolidation model, what we are looking to is how do we strategically move to say a 30 or 35 exam station model, which doesn't leave any corner of the state. I have it, I have it planned by counties, and how can we set it up in such a way that no corner of the state has an inordinate amount of burden to travel to their closest exam station. So that's focus on the consolidation. So our hope is to go down to 30 to 35 locations, but a lot of these locations were doing either only road tests or only knowledge tests or only transactions. The ones that we focus on will be robust and will have all options. Road tests, online tests, transactions, all of the options. So those exam stations will give you everything you need. And as we are deciding on these, we are looking at where are our partners. As you know, my personal focus has been building a strong relationship with our deputy registrars and our business partners. And so we're looking at where are the deputy registrars, because they provide all the transactions. The only thing now with the online test available as well, the only thing folks need to come to us for is the road test. And the road test you usually do once or twice in your lifetime. So our focus is a model keeping in mind current deputy registrars, and the exam stations that we have will have full service, robust service delivery. That's our focus. And Representative Kosnick, I'm happy to send you some more information on that.
Representative Kosnick?
Thank you, Representative or Vice Chair Cagle. Director Corey, could you just give us an update on the scheduling times? How far out are that? That was a big issue. It still is a big issue to many constituents. And I'd like to just get an update from you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I did a check just this morning, and at least, you know, just examples of exam stations that have openings right away. You know, in February, we've got Anoka, Arden Hills. I'm looking at my list here. You know, Winona as early as 2nd of March. We're looking at Bemidji has openings as of today, tomorrow, and day after. Egan has options of 23rd of February. Plymouth has an option. So we've got openings in the next 2 weeks. We have openings in at least 6 to 8 of the currently open exam stations.
Are you able to just, Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Kosnick.
Can you give us a number of how many openings in the next 2 weeks, or do you not have it broken down like that? And then we'll move on. I don't want to monopolize the time here.
Commissioner Corey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For example,
Director Corey.
thank you, Chair, Madam Chair. Representative Kosnick, I'm looking at my list in Duluth for the 23rd of February. That is 24th of February, there are 30 appointments for tomorrow that are available today in Duluth for tomorrow. For tomorrow in the Virginia exam station, there are 13 appointments available. For tomorrow in the Cambridge exam station, there are 3 appointments available. Grand Rapids has 5 appointments available tomorrow. Moorhead has 11 appointments available. St. Cloud has 3 appointments available tomorrow, 16 appointments available on the 26th. So those are just some examples.
Thank you, Director Corey. And we have just a few minutes left in this section. So we have Representative Elkins, and then on deck is Representative Mason. So Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Chair and Director Corey. I'm going to just follow up on the line of questioning from Representative Petersburg. So if this is going to be the year that we make the big push, you know, to get people onto Real ID, all of those applications have to be made in person. And I'm still not hearing that we're going to have the capacity at the deputy registrar stations in order to handle that surge in demand for Real ID applications. So Bloomington finally made a decision to permanently close its deputy registrar station in order to eliminate a $300,000 a year deficit that office was running. I know that the deputy registrars in general are barely hanging on with their current fee structure. And you know, one of the features of MnDrive was to push more of the work out to the point of customer contact, get the data right as it's entered there, in order for there to be less work that needed to be done in the back room. And we haven't made any changes in the way we compensate the deputy registrars to make sure that they're being held whole for all of this extra work we're asking them to do. And I'm concerned that we're going to end up having additional deputy registrar closings all over the state, just as we need them to actually be adding capacity in order to handle Real ID applications.
Director Corey?
Madam Chair, Representative Elkins, I definitely want to share my sentiments on the fact that I look at our deputy registrars and our DL agents as an extension of our service. Absolutely incredibly important to our service delivery model. We, in fact, as of yesterday, were working together on how we can make certain processes easier at the counter at our deputy registrars. I'll give an example. You talked about Real ID. We have a system, when you think about improvements in Minnesota Drive and enhancements, we have given our chairs of our deputy registrar organizations voting rights and ability to be able to add their priorities of enhancements to the system. Never before. And so we have them at the table to make our systems and processes better because we have a common goal of better service for the customers. Now, I will agree that my staff and our deputy registrars, they all have this learning curve right now with the new system. But this system is going to make it easier and less time for all transactions as our staff get really comfortable with the system. So for Real ID, one of the things that we are putting in place right now is that you and me, if we want a Real ID, we can upload our documents directly into the MnDrive system so that they can be looked at by DVS. So when you go to the deputy registrar, now the deputy registrar doesn't have angry customers saying, why aren't you accepting our document? They can pull up their report and they will see those documents. So we're working on making it easier for the deputy registrars. It will get easier as the learning curve of the new system, takes its time. But I completely agree that they are an incredibly important part of our solution model. So our support for them will continue. Our support and our allowing them to be involved in solutions will continue.
And I have to say, Director, that all of the deputy registrars I've spoken with have been extremely complimentary of the cooperative working relationship between your people and the deputy registrars in the development of MnDrive.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Last question for this section is Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is to the Director. There was one slide where you showed that the Real ID deadline is in October, but the amount for the money goes into 21, but the money is taken out of 22. So just trying to make sure I understand that.
Director Corey?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Mason. Yes, if we have the funds for fiscal year 22, that means July 1 of this year, we will begin to be able to use that funding. And it was appropriated to us earlier, but of course, because of COVID, because we did not use it, it was canceled back to the fund. So we're basically just saying to reappropriate it to us, and it will be available to us for the crucial months of July, August, September, October, and as you know, into the next few months post Real ID. And as we know, travel starts, but travel will progress over time. So we hope to have it for those crucial months starting July 1 of 2021.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, Commissioner Harrington, Colonel Langer, and Director Corey. Next, we'll hear from advocates from the Disability Council of Minnesota. So ARC Minnesota Autism Society, and they have been organizing and meeting virtually for their day off the Hill today. So first up, we have Lisa Black.
Hello, I'm Lisa A.S. Black. I am a private citizen, a homemaker, employed part-time by my husband here on the L&L Black Farms. Representative Charleston may remember me as Lisa Schwanholz, or Americanized Spanholz, when I worked with Senator Danny Ferguson on his legislative intern as an intern on his legislative staff in the mid-1990s. I have been advocating for better funding, better funded transit in Greater Minnesota since mid-1990s. Thank you for allowing me to finally speak today. I hope everyone got the resolution that I sent, providing funding for intercounty public transportation. I want to thank the Minnesota Brain Injury Alliance for helping me draft this and putting my testimony together. Also Lisa, hier müsst ihr nur auf Englisch sprechen, sonst verstehen Sie die gar nicht. In December 1992, exactly 3 months after having returned from a year of study abroad in Germany, I was in a serious car accident, giving me numerous broken bones and a traumatic brain injury that put me in a coma for 5.5 weeks. I came out of that coma speaking the language that had been my host for 13 months, just 3 months previously. Thus, I had to be told, Lisa, here you have to speak only English, otherwise no one will understand you. I do not have any memory of coming home in August. 3 important months of my life is completely lost. My father tells me that about a month into my hospital stay, while I was still comatose, he was told to look for a nursing home for me because I would never be self-sufficient. By God's grace, broken bones heal, and I have learned many, many memory helpers. However, one of the many difficulties that I continue to deal with is my struggle with safe driving. This is largely due to my double vision. I like to joke that I see twice as good as most people. There's a lot of irony in that statement. This is due to my double vision and my trouble with depth perception. Nerves that control the movement in my left eye were damaged in the accident, and the message from the nerves is not correctly translated in my brain. Also, due to the brain injury, my decision-making is not swift enough to drive safely in heavy traffic. Because of the double vision, I do not drive at night. In 1991 and 92, while I was a student in Germany, a country much the size of our state of Minnesota, I depended entirely on public transportation, and I was able to travel the country extensively. While I was a student at the University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, I rode the transit buses often. There is a park and ride service in which I could drive to an outer Twin Cities suburb connecting to the transit system. However, these transit lines are serviced only weekdays. Thus, I cannot get to weekend events in the Twin Cities. How to find those transit times and connecting bus numbers also needs to be made more easily available. In 2018, when I went to the state capitol with my county's volunteer driver service, it cost me $180 round trip. This service is no longer available. Today, I would need to use the smart ride system of the Sibley McLeod Area Regional Transit System. At $2.50 a loaded mile, it would have cost me $525 round trip to come to today's meeting to testify. I'm sorry, that's way out of my pocketbook. County transit systems need funding for capital and operating operations within Sibley and other counties. And you need to allow these systems to cross county lines. Rural transit is lacking in Minnesota. It needs more funding. Transit is only a small portion of the general fund balance. I've been advocating for more funding for rural transportation systems since 1995. I'm often told when I testify that, oh, we support public transit funding. Forgive my sassiness, my mother would not approve. I ask you to, quote, put your money where your mouth is, unquote. Please grant county transit systems more funding. Help me get there.
Thank you, Ms. Black. Next up on the list, we have Gregory White. Gregory, are you with us? I see he's here.
I'm calling Madam Chair. I'm seeing if we can get him on. This is John.
Yep.
You may want to move on to the next testifier while we're working with him here.
All right. So the next testifier is Jillian Nelson. You could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Hornstein and committee members. I thank you for your invitation to speak here today. I am Jillian Nelson, and I am the Community Resource and Policy Advocate for the Autism Society of Minnesota. I'm also an autistic adult. Transportation is something I have spent an incredible amount of time throughout my life thinking about. I personally did not have a driver's license since I was 34 years old. So for many years, I was dependent on public transportation to live my life. This dictated every piece of my world, where I could live, where I could work, how I got medical care, social interactions. Most people understood that I didn't drive because of my disability, but they also assumed I had access to things like metro mobility or medical transportation to support that. I had neither. I'm not alone in that. Most people with autism don't. That's a different hearing. And I did. The limitation that those programs have in place are not always the most helpful in creating accessibility. For example, unpredictable ride times, lateness, limited hours. Those things don't exactly foster self-determination in how we live our lives. Due to very limited public transportation on the outskirts of the metro area and greater Minnesota, like Lisa just spoke about, a trip to the grocery store could take upwards of 3 hours. So I had to limit my housing searches to the inner city. And even then, my work commute on public transportation would take me 90 minutes. Had I lived in the suburb, that would have been at least an hour longer. Our current transit planning models segregate people with disabilities to metro areas if they want the widest freedom of movement. Unfortunately, accessible housing and affordable housing is limited there. So this is a large burden on people who already face disproportionate rates of unemployment or underemployment. So many people have to make the choice to move places with limited transit. In these suburban areas or in greater Minnesota, there are 2 or 3 routes that run limited times a day, typically to accommodate commuters moving in and out of the cities, rather than to improve the livability in an area for all the people in the community. The last piece I want to talk about is accessibility in public transit. Our public transit system is designed to meet compliance standards. They have ramps and tie downs and handrails to support riders with physical disabilities. However, the features that create accessibility for people with disabilities like autism or vision impairment or intellectual disabilities are often overlooked as bonus features rather than necessary for accessibility. My community depends on the verbal announcements or visual signs of stops to help track where to get off the bus. But far too often, these are turned off or out of order, and the bus driver was rarely making announcements over the microphone. Personally, as a person with a non-apparent disability, I was often denied access to disability priority seating, despite having balance and coordination issues related to my disability, because the transit drivers did not have training in accessibility and disability other than how to use the tie downs. This lack of understanding and awareness created repetitive access barriers that were unpredictable. I never knew if a ride would go smoothly or not, and that unknown is terrifying. Also within the accessibility planning of public transit, we need to address rerouting. When buses or train stops need to be moved for construction, often the changes made remove accessibility or create huge barriers, both for autistic people in terms of navigating a sensory challenging space or walking extended distances through unpredictable areas, but also for people with mobility needs. Moving a bus 2 blocks might not seem that big, but when that bus was already a 2-block walk from other high frequency areas, that's now a double distance without changing the schedule or consideration of accessibility. To sum it all up, what we need is consideration of what accessibility really looks like to maintain people with invisible disabilities utilizing public transportation in a meaningful way that improves community access. For someone like me, it appears that our transit system has lost sight of the reality that the ADA protects access to public spaces for all people with disabilities, not just those with physical needs. Without broadening the lens in which we view disability in planning the infrastructure of our state, we will be continuing to perpetuate and even contribute to the disparities people face in living equitable, self-determined lives. Thank you so much for your time today and for your commitment to improving transportation for the entire disability community. Your work is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, Ms. Nelson. And looks like we are going to be moving to Trevor Turner next. So if you could just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Trevor Turner. I am also the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Council on Disability, First, I want to give a little bit of background why we were asked to speak today. So this morning, we actually had our Disability Day off the Capitol. And so we had about 300 people on a Zoom call to talk about issues and bring about disability issues in the state of Minnesota. And we also had, you know, what we call lunch and learns about specific topics. And one of our topics was transportation. So I actually invited members of this committee to come participate in that lunch and learn. But it just so happened that this hearing occurred at the exact same time we had that scheduled. So fortunately, Chair Hornstein reached out and said, well, why don't you present at the hearing today instead? So we're here to kind of highlight those disability issues and to kind of bring this hearing into kind of a part of our Disability Day off at the Capitol. One of the things that we definitely want to highlight is that, you know, as Ms. Black and Ms. Nelson have talked about, transportation accessibility issues for public transit and also in greater Minnesota. I myself have a disability where I have a severe hearing loss. I wear hearing aids to aid in that. And then I also have been going blind since I was 13 years old. Most people don't notice that because blindness is, you know, it's a spectrum. And so, but I am legally blind. I do not drive. And like Ms. Black, I had the privilege of being able to live in Europe and Germany, and also I lived in East Asia and in East Africa. And one thing I can tell you my experience there is that when I was taking public transit in those places, I never felt like I was taking public transit because of my disability. You know, in those places, the transit systems are so integrated into everyone's lives, interwoven in everyone's lives, that everybody takes public transit. It is not something that's reserved for people with disabilities or people in lower economic statuses. It's something that the rich, poor, able-bodied, white, black, anyone takes, and it's part of their regular daily commute. And frankly, sometimes it's more efficient and convenient to take public transit over driving. Unfortunately, I don't feel that way here in Minnesota. I do feel I take public transit here, and I want to thank Metro Transit and the state of Minnesota and the Department of Transportation for providing those opportunities. And they're doing the best that they absolutely can with the resources they have. However, unfortunately, in our country, in America, we're a car-centered, cultured society. It's basically been that way since post-World War II, and Eisenhower, when he built the interstate system, just really encouraged driving. And as more and more people, you know, took the road, got the driver's license, started avoiding cars, that meant more congestion. Well, when that congestion happened, instead of, you know, improving public transit and trains and buses and things like that, we just widened roads, and which, you know, definitely reduced you know, congestion for people who can drive, but it only exacerbated the, you know, the accessibility option for transportation for people with disabilities. So I think the ultimate point that I hope that you all can take away from this is that when we are talking about transportation, that, you know, keeping people with disabilities in mind not only helps people with disabilities, you know, it does things like reduce, you know, pollution and our carbon footprint. It also makes things more convenient and provides better accessibility for everyone. So designing a transportation system with disability in mind doesn't just benefit people with disabilities, but it also benefits the entire state of Minnesota. So thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take any questions or anything like that.
Thank you so much. Mr. Howe, do we have Mr. White?
I've been unable to get him back in, so I will alert you if we're able to successfully bring him back in, but I think he's having some difficulty with technical issues on his end.
Okay, so we will move to member questions. I don't see any right now. Are there any members that have questions for the testifiers? I don't see any. So I just want to thank the testifiers so much for coming and sharing their perspective on public transportation and what the state can do to help make it better. So with that, then I think we will move on to the statewide pedestrian system plan. So we have a draft or an overview of the draft statewide pedestrian system plan from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And we will also hear from R Streets Minneapolis. Representative Chair Hornstein, did you want to kick this off?
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Vice Chair Cagle. And I also want to thank the testifiers from the Council of Disability and other organizations. Very important issue for this committee to deal with as we put together our omnibus bill. So thank you for the testifiers, and thank you to the Department of Public Safety for the budget overview. And I think that one of the takeaways is really, you know, this real ID issue, as well as the driver license exam issue, I think are of concern to the committee and deputy registrars again as well. So we'll be paying attention to that as we put our bill together and move forward. So members, the last part of the agenda today involves our pedestrian system plan for MnDOT. Now, there's a draft plan that they have put together. And of course, this also relates very directly to some of the concerns raised earlier in the hearing. So we're going to hear from that plan, and then we're going to hear from a very active nonprofit that's been addressing issues of pedestrian safety following that, and then we'll be adjourning on time at 2:30. So with that, members, I'd like to call on Jake Ruger from MnDOT, who will present the draft statewide pedestrian system plan from the Minnesota Department of Transportation. Mr. Ruger, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jake Ruder, and I am a pedestrian and bicycle planner with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I'd like to thank you all for the time today to come and share an update on our draft statewide pedestrian system plan with you all. Before we get into what the plan covers, I want to let you and other folks who are watching today know that the Minnesota Department of Transportation defines walking using the National Center on Physical Activity and Disabilities definition of walking. And that is inclusive of all the ways that people move themselves through the world, including with mobility devices like walkers, strollers, and wheelchairs. During our time together today, I'll walk you through the project goals for the statewide pedestrian system plan. I'll talk you through an overview of the process we undertook to complete this planning document. We'll go through some of the engagement highlights and what we heard from people in Minnesota, and then we'll talk high level about what's in the plan. So the goals of the statewide pedestrian system plan are to promote walking as a universal need, to create healthy and equitable communities, to create safer places to walk, to create enjoyable places to walk, and to build internal capacity to advance walking. And these five goals really frame the way that we approach discussion about how MnDOT can invest in improving walking throughout the state in the plan itself. We kicked off this planning process in February of 2019, beginning with a meeting with a group of internal stakeholders to talk about what needs we identified and how this plan could come together. We did our first phase of public engagement in the summer of 2019. That was all across the state of Minnesota. We were able to go to events, be there in person, and have conversations with people about walking along and across MnDOT roadways. Once we had done that first phase of public engagement, we then pivoted to connecting with our internal stakeholders to better understand the sort of challenges that people are running into in making places better to walk, the issues that folks saw on projects and heard from communities in terms of how we can help to make walking safer and easier for folks. We worked through both that first phase of public engagement and the internal engagement to come up with a series of process recommendations that focus on the key areas where we think we can improve and better deliver a system for people walking. Those are really the meaty chapters of the draft plan. And then we went back to the public for a second phase of engagement. This began after the pandemic was in full swing. So our phase two engagement was 100% virtually conducted using an online survey and targeted social media buys to try and connect with folks. We also used sidewalk clings that stick down onto sidewalks or trails to give people to a website, and we could interact with them that way. On December 8th, we released to the public this draft statewide pedestrian system plan that was available for public comment through January 11th, and we're currently working on revisions to the plan based on those comments. So really high level, I want to share with you all what we heard from our stakeholders. We were able to connect with more than 2,700 people statewide. Of that group, nearly 3 out of 4 people told us that they completely support improvements for walking. The top desired policy change was improvements to our winter maintenance practices and making sure that our facilities are usable year round. 85% of respondents noted that they highly support the installation of a demonstration project, which is a temporary change to the roadway to advance pedestrian safety features and mimic some of the longer term fixes that we might make on a permanent project. And some of the most popular design choices that folks let us know they're interested in are things like curb extensions, refuge islands, and more time to cross streets. So this slide shows an image of what a demonstration project can look like. This one replicates the bump outs that sometimes are built into curbs using plastic delineators and traffic paint to create a bump out space where a person can step out and be more visible and able to see vehicles more easily. We also did high visibility crosswalks at this intersection to help improve the crossing experience. The plan itself uses a goal, objective, and action item structure. If you are digging into the plan, this is sort of the easiest way to dig into the parts of it that you may be most interested in. Just as an example, we'll take goal 2 and objective 2.1, which is to center equitable outcomes as part of the project development process, including an emphasis on prioritizing the system's most vulnerable users. The action items listed here include investment planning 4, which is to work with MnDOT traffic safety staff to review the outcomes of field walks. So that's continuing to work with our partners in traffic engineering to identify places in the scoping phase, where we can make improvements for people walking. And we also have performance measures to track our progress over time and make sure that we are making improvements as we go. So why are we investing in walking? We heard again, referencing back to our engagement push, that Minnesotans support investments in walking. 74% of our engagement respondents fully support these investments. Walking benefits our communities. So we know that improvements to walking deliver social, economic, environmental, and health benefits to people throughout Minnesota. And MnDOT also has an opportunity to lead here. We have a reputation among state DOTs as a state organization that has delivered and really is doing a good job on improving places for people to walk. And we can continue to build on that by delivering the recommendations in this plan. These recommendations include rectifying inequities where we have perhaps had a project in the past that divided the pedestrian network, and also mitigating the impacts of climate change on folks who are walking. So then we get into talking about how we plan for investments. And this begins with a sort of section that documents the ways that MnDOT plans and policies affect outcomes for people walking, the different ways that plans lead to projects, and ultimately the things that people experience in the real world. We also talk about our priority areas for investment. This is a data-driven approach that uses 19 different criteria to highlight the places in Minnesota where we believe, based on a number of different indicators, that the need for walking improvements is greater. And then finally, investment planning scenarios to help us understand an estimate of what the cost would be to deliver improvements along and across the trunk highway system in areas with the greatest levels of need. So we do the why should we invest, how should we invest, and then we get into our process improvements. And these are really where we get into the nuts and bolts of things that we can do at MnDOT to make the outcomes better for folks in communities. First is looking at our cost participation policy. The statewide pedestrian system plan does not change MnDOT's cost participation policy, but it does recommend best practices to work within the existing policy. And we really approach this with the question in mind of, if walking is one of MnDOT's priorities, how do we invest in a way that reflects that as being true and helps to assist in bringing these improvements to bear in communities across the state? We look closely at maintenance. In this particularly, we know that many times we sign an agreement with a local unit of government to do winter maintenance on our facilities. And so one of the things that we're really focused on is identifying opportunities where we can bring our local partners into a conversation when we're designing a project and identify the ways that that project can be built so that maintenance in the wintertime is easier, that it holds up to the equipment that the locals are using, and that there's appropriate place for snow storage. And then finally, scoping a need. This includes some recommended improvements that should be considered based on the project type and land use context. So we're really setting the table for where the conversation should start as far as making improvements for people walking. There are a few different important touch points that I'd like to hit on as well. First is the concept of vulnerability. So across a number of factors, people who are walking are the most vulnerable users of the transportation system. They don't have protection from the elements, they don't have climate control, they don't have safety features that come in vehicles, and they're the slowest moving users of the system. So really, any way that we look at it, folks who are walking are the most vulnerable people on the system. We also talk about speed and safety. So slower speeds save lives. And the reason that we say that is that the lower the speed is, the less energy transfer happens when a crash occurs. And ultimately that reduces harm for people walking as well as everybody involved in a crash. There's a statistic on the slide that says that a person who's hit by a vehicle at 25 miles an hour has an 89% chance of surviving that incident, while a person hit at 45 miles an hour has a 35% chance of surviving. And finally, climate mitigation and adaptation. So climate change impacts people walking directly through changes in temperature, more high heat days, precipitation in terms of higher precipitation events and greater heavy rains, and also air quality. And so the plan looks at ways that MnDOT can direct investment to mitigate the impacts on those users of our system who are walking. So with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to give an overview of this plan, and I'm happy to answer questions and respond as best I can.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reuter. We'll have one more presenter, and then if we have some time for a couple of questions after that, we'll take them then. But I did want to just, again, thank you for this draft. Again, this is preliminary, members. There'll be a final report coming to us. But this issue really, you know, I think has always been critical for this committee, but it really came into focus for me over the last couple of years. I was invited to different members were hosting events or town meetings in their district because of some tragedies that took place. Pedestrians being hit, bikers being hit. I was at one very well attended meeting in Eagan. I went to a school, I think it was in Deep Haven or Chanhassen out in the western suburbs. A lot of parents concerned about their kids' safety crossing a busy street near the school. And literally all over the state, we're having these kinds of conversations. In the district I represent, there's a lot of concern about Lindale Avenue South. And a lot of pedestrian incidents in the uptown area of Minneapolis. So this is truly a statewide issue. And you know, I'm glad that you've presented this draft for us, and we look forward to the final report. So members, I did want to make sure that we heard a perspective, a citizen-based perspective as well on this report and on this issue. And so I'm very happy that we have Ashwat Narayanan, who is the executive director of an organization called Our Streets in Minneapolis. And they have been, I think, leading the way in terms of addressing this issue from a citizen-based public policy and organizing perspective. So Mr. Narayanan, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record. We'll hear from you and then member questions following your presentation. And as Mr. Howe, are we having some issues here? I see Mr. Narayanan and his name on here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. My name is Ash Narayanan, and I'm the executive director at Our Streets Minneapolis.
You can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. So we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy organization working to make the city of Minneapolis a place where anyone can easily and comfortably bike, walk, and roll. So today, across the country, we have an epidemic of traffic crashes on our streets. We have nearly 40,000 people down. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Are you able to hear me okay?
Yes, we can now. You cut out for a second, but now you're back.
Okay. And close to 40,000 people die each year as a result of these traffic crashes in the U.S., with over 350 people losing their lives in Minnesota alone each year as well. And so we often refer to these crashes as accidents. However, this loss of life is no accident. Many of our streets and roads are often dangerous by design. And that's because our infrastructure decisions are made with the end goals of getting people and cars to their destinations as quickly as possible. And this model of transportation investment has come at a huge societal cost, one that is the equivalent of a full jumbo jet crashing each week in the United States with no survivors. And like Chair Hornstein was saying, the most vulnerable people on our streets are often pedestrians. Pedestrian deaths have increased steadily nationwide since 2009. There are also huge racial disparities in who is most at risk for a crash. Native American community members and Black community members are much more likely to be hurt or killed while walking on our streets. Today, we have an opportunity to not only eliminate these severe injuries and fatal crashes, but to also create healthy, equitable, and delightful communities for all of us, regardless of our age, race, physical ability, or gender, are able to access all the resources that we need on foot, or by bike, on wheelchairs, or even electric scooters. I'm therefore thrilled that the Minnesota Department of Transportation has released the draft MnDOT statewide pedestrian system plan. I think this comprehensive plan is the first step towards making walking easy and comfortable for everyone in our state. Indeed, as Jake was saying, MnDOT is one of the only agencies nationally that has made progress on reducing pedestrian crashes. The plan lays out a series of actions that we can take today to improve access to walking and making our streets safer. It takes a comprehensive, integrated approach to transportation investment, and it explicitly seeks to move us away from this car-centric system to one that changes how space is allocated on our public roadways. I think if implemented thoughtfully, this plan can right-size our roadways, and I quote from the plan, create places where people want to walk rather than places where people can walk if they must. The plan's recommendations are also incredibly cost-effective. In the most expensive scenario outlined in the plan, creating a comprehensive series of walking actions statewide will cost us $600 million. While this may seem expensive at face value, this is the same amount that the loss of life and severe injuries inflicts upon Minnesota in just 2 years, according to the plan. It's also a small fraction of the $7 billion that MnDOT spends biannually. So improving walking statewide will not just reduce traffic crashes, it will also have a direct and significant impact towards reducing racial disparities in transportation. If walking becomes easier and more comfortable, people will see it as a way to go about their daily life, reducing car trips and carbon emissions. Improving walking is a critical tool in our fight against climate change, and our communities will become more pleasant places to live in. I strongly support this draft statewide pedestrian system plan and its adoption and its implementation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Narayan. And members, if you have any questions of either Mr. Reuter or Mr. Narayan, now would be the time, and I'll scan my participant list. Yes, Representative Petersburg and then Representative Cagle. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this one is to Mr. Reuter. In regards to your survey in which you talk about the prioritizing of walking and so forth, you talked about engaged responders and 75% of them. Do you have a number of how many people actually responded to this, and were they primarily people who were already walkers, or was it a diverse clientele that actually answered that questionnaire?
Mr. Reuter.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Petersburg and members of the committee. We did not have a question in our survey that asked a person how often that they walked places, so we don't have a way to identify if they're a person who's already walking along the system. The number of 2,700 respondents is statewide. We did strive to make sure that our survey was representative of the state of Minnesota in terms of population, and particularly who we heard from, that it created a subset and a significant sample of the folks who are in the state. I can't give you a specific breakdown of how offhand of how it broke out between, for instance, Greater Minnesota and the Twin Cities metro area, but that's information I can provide to you at a later date.
Thank you, Mr. Reuter. Representative Petersburg, any follow-up?
Well, yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. It just seemed like you talked about putting on sidewalks, the ability to log on and join a link to answer that questionnaire. So it seemed like you were targeting those that are already walking, which means that you're kind of going to be looking at the predominant number of people that are going to be looking for improvements in walking. Same thing would do if we were to talk about those driving cars, whether or not we think if we only ask people driving cars, what they would prefer to be improved on, obviously, would be driving. So I just want to make sure that we have a diverse group and that this wasn't just for walkers. And that was my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Cagle, Vice Chair Cagle, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know I've been one of those squeaky wheels about pedestrian safety because we have some very dangerous intersections up in my neck of the woods. But I also would like wanted to ask a question. I was glad to see that the winter maintenance is an issue that's been elevated, and was kind of curious about what the relationship is between MnDOT, Metro Transit, cities and counties, and private properties for making sure that you know, those areas are cleared. Every morning I drop off my daughter at daycare, and there's a bus stop coming out that is completely covered with snow. And so I don't know how people access it, how, I mean, the bench is just there completely buried. And so I'm just kind of curious about how often sites are looked at to see if they're being maintained. And then, you know, really, where does the responsibility fall? Because I see, you know, transit and pedestrian, you know, transit and walking are kind of hand in hand. You know, it's not elementary school where we get picked up right at the end of our driveway. You know, we have to go to a place, and most likely we have to walk there to get to that place to be picked up. And so every morning when I see that bus that bus bench, it just drives me nuts. And so just kind of curious about how those relationships are and how often you're looking at those sites.
And I'm thinking that would be a question for Mr. Reuter, correct? Mr. Reuter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, and members of the committee. Looking into how we track our maintenance agreements is one of the big action items in the statewide pedestrian system plan. So typically when we do a project, we sign an agreement with a unit of government that looks after maintenance, particularly seasonal maintenance. The plan identifies a need to establish and dedicate resources to tracking the implementation of those agreements, and to make sure that we are not just tracking agreements to see if the work is happening, but also to look at the agreements on the front end and make sure that what we're asking local units of government to agree to is something that is reasonable and makes sense for all the parties involved.
Representative Cagle, did you want to follow up? Or
yes, Mr. Chair, I was just kind of curious about if there is any consequence, or you know, what happens if those agreements aren't being upheld, because that's just my question.
Mr. Reuter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, and members of the committee. I do not know if there's a specific consequence if those agreements are not upheld, but that's one of the things that is a part of that suite of action items that we'll be tackling.
Thank you. And Representative Cagle, I just wanted to, you had mentioned your advocacy on pedestrian safety. I wanted to thank you for that. And it reminded me of the really informative trip that we took pre-COVID last year. Representative Heinrich, we looked at Highway 10 up in the area he represents that has had some pedestrian issues. We saw some areas in Blaine. Representative West's area, Representative Bernardi has been a longtime advocate in her area and on active transportation in general. So it just reminded me of that North Metro trip, which again, I think has a lot of issues and but reflective of really the entire state, but particularly there, we have a lot of members on this committee that have raised this issue up given their districts. Last question belongs to Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first I do want to thank Mr. Narayanan, to sit close.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for your comments. I really appreciate that. And just a little bit about my experience. I grew up in a city, and on our lot, there were three residences. My father had the only car, and there were many households that didn't have any cars at all. So most of us were using buses all the time to commute. And then I moved to Minnesota, where when I first moved to my community, there were very few sidewalks. And I remember early on, and this is when I was serving on the city council, we had a blind man that wanted to be able to catch a bus. It was okay, but there was no... but we were not cleaning the trails or sidewalks, et cetera, so he could get to that. And he was, and we had one person on the city council who was adamant about not cleaning sidewalks because it was a liability. Only place in the world where you can't clean sidewalks. But so, I mean, it was a real what they want, you know, the suggestion was to use metro mobility. And the man kept saying, I'm not disabled. I can walk to the bus. You just need to be able to clear the sidewalk. And I do want to say, so what I've been seeing in Minnesota is a real culture change that we need, where in Eagan now, for instance, most of our trails are, they're cleaned year round, so people can use them. But I also know that many people that drive cars look on people on bicycles or on walking as impediments rather than somebody that actually should be able to use the same resources. So again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. That's a good note to end on. Representative Mason, I want to thank Mr. Reuter and Mr. Narayanan for your excellent comments. And again, we'll be looking towards making sure that active transportation in all of its forms and bike and pedestrian infrastructure and safety are a part of the work of this committee moving forward. So thank you very much, members. Before we adjourn, I just, Representative Petersburg, is that, did you have your hand up still? Or?
Well, I just wanted to talk about Friday and yeah, what the plan is for that. So
I'm about to say that, members, because just the plan for the rest of the week is our regularly scheduled hearing time on Thursday. We'll be hearing a number of bills on bus rapid transit, arterial bus rapid transit, that is. And then we have added a hearing. This just was posted, I believe, for Friday. Members, we're going to be, look, as we enter into this March busy season, we will be adding hearings as needed, most likely on Fridays. I'm trying to avoid evenings. We will have one Friday at 1 o'clock, and this is going to be Representative Elkins's transit safety bill. And we heard a version of that last year from Representative Tabke. So we are going to take a lot of time on that hearing. We have a lot of interest in this committee, a lot of interest in the community. And so we'll be hearing that. I imagine there'll be some amendments to that. So that will be the agenda for Friday at 1 o'clock, Representative Petersburg.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So are you planning on sending that out of committee that day, or are you going to be holding on to it?
Well, this bill will need to go to the Public Safety Committee. We're not going to likely carry it in the omnibus bill at this time. Perhaps it could be returned to our committee for inclusion in an omnibus, but right now we do plan on voting that out of committee on Friday, because it does need to go to the Public Safety Committee.
Okay,
I don't think it
you.
Needs to go to judiciary, but it absolutely has to go to public safety.
All right, thank you.
Okay, members, and always contact Mr. Howe if you have any questions about any kind of committee scheduling or process. And with that, we are adjourned, and I'll see you on Thursday. Have a good rest of the afternoon, everybody.